Good morning, everyone, and welcome once again to the other side of midnight, that amazing time between dusk and dawn when things can be just a little bit different than during the normal light of day. We have a very interesting program for you this evening, or this morning, depending upon where you are on this rotating globe of ours. Something seems to be amiss with our music. There we are. Okay. Wrong switch. Sorry. I want to do a couple things this morning first before I bring in my guest. We're going to be talking, among other things, about pyramids. So I want everyone to go to othersideofmidnight.com. That's our website, othersideofmidnight.com. Click on our guest's info tonight, Dr. Carmen Bolter, and that will take you to her page. And at the very top of her page, next to the Radio with Pictures logo, there is an image I put up, the first image before Carmen's. Click on that, and you will see the most remarkable, the most amazing pyramidal structure that I have ever seen in any extraterrestrial imaging that I've looked at over the last 10, 20, 30-some years. This is the 12-mile-wide, 4-mile-high, unique, one-of-a-kind mountain, NASA claims, on the surface of Ceres, a globe which is 600 miles in diameter, give or take, and you can tally up the number of tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of square miles. So we've got one object that looks like this, and if you look at it closely, it's a pyramid. It's a vast pyramidal arcology on the surface of Ceres. It's about 11 degrees north in terms of the global grid, and it is in fascinating condition because you can see all kinds of symmetry and geometry on both the wide angle and the close-up. So I just wanted to put that at the top to kind of begin the program, because if we are going to ever figure out our history, if we're going to figure out who the heck we are, then I think we have to go a bit further back in time than the conversation that Dr. Bolter and I are going to have this morning. Moving on, I want everyone to know that I've been keeping pace with the current political developments. As you know, we have been citing the Trump phenomenon at some length, because this is, to me, a harbinger of a changing physics where people seem impelled, with no governors, to simply speak their truth in national forums, in national media, in blogs, on the web, all over the planet in various forms. And the most extraordinarily interesting example currently of that particular behavior is a certain presidential candidate on the Republican side here in the United States called Donald Trump. Over the weekend, he has put out his first policy paper dealing with immigration, and it's quite obvious to me that that is a conversation unto itself, so I will assemble some interesting people, and we're going to try something new when we do open lines on a subject like this. I'm going to actually try to put a number of you into a conference call so we can all talk with each other and we can share opinions. And this is kind of the electronic version of what Long John Neville did many, many decades ago in New York in that famous studio in WOR. So, without further ado, let me move on to the topic of this evening, which is an ancient civilization lying by the Nile, full of mystery, full of inviting charms, extraordinary mysteries, dark alleys, convoluted narratives. Carmen, have I done justice to what you've tackled over the last, how many years have you been doing this?
Since 1977, I went to Egypt for the first time.
Oh my gosh. Let me introduce everyone tonight to Dr. Carmen Bolter. How do I pronounce your name properly?
Bolter.
Bolter, Bolter. Like nuts and Bolter.
Yep.
Okay. Well, we're going to be talking about nuts and bolts when it comes to Egypt. You have a degree, and I must say it has completely escaped me what the degree is in, because I always think of you as an Egyptologist.
Well, actually, it's linguistics. Oh. My PhD is in linguistics, and it's actually educational technology, and my master's was in educational psychology.
Well, that's an interesting combination to attack an ancient civilization trying to tell us something that we haven't figured out yet.
Mm-hmm.
So where did you want to begin tonight? I've got a whole bunch of imaging pictures. You've been to Egypt 25 times since 77. You headed some other interesting projects. For instance, you created something on television called The Pyramid Code. You were the director, the producer, the writer, the head grip. You were almost everything on that. But I've seen it on various networks, and it really is an amazing piece of work. It really gets into the idea of Egypt as more than just the stones that we can see.
That's right. Yeah, it's actually been, I've been to Egypt 29 times.
Oh.
But last time you and I talked, you had sent me a picture of something that had been photographed off Google Earth. Off the satellite scan, remember?
I remember.
Okay, so the trapezoid pictures are here, and then there was things that really looked like some kind of a landing pad or something, and so I ended up organizing a desert expedition and going in with Dr. Konstantin Korotkov, a Russian scientist, with some really sensitive equipment, and we had to go in with a hot air balloon, and it was a military zone. And it ended up not being, we thought it may have had ties to Atlantis. But the point here is that I've been looking for this place for 25 years. And so through various experiences that I've had, past life memories, consultations with people who do past life regressions, just this whole myriad of clues that have been pushing me toward finding this place. And so when we went, we found it, both sites, and it turned out once we landed that it was actually a target for the Air Force and that there was all kinds of unexploded landmines. It was a military area. We had to get special permits to get in, and it was quite modern. So from Google Earth, it looked like those walls were about 30 feet thick, and it did look like there was something that was shaped like a pyramid, which could have been the top of an obelisk, and it turned out that it was a small cement pyramid that they had built as a target for the planes flying over.
This was in the center of that ring.
That's correct.
Okay.
And so it was, you know, really isolated, really dangerous, but the thing was falling apart. It probably was about 30 years old, and it was completely falling apart. And so it just, you know, kind of made me smile to think that something not very old at all wouldn't withstand the test of time even for a few decades. That was one point, but the other one was that we had this sensitive equipment that could measure the energy fields in this place.
Mm-hmm.
It's called an eco-tester, and it was developed over many years in Russia by Dr. Konstantin Korotkov, who was with us. And the energy of the place was really, like the earth itself, was still really disturbed from having bombs dropped on it.
I can well imagine, yes.
And the resonant field kept that charge, which I found really interesting. So anyway, so that was a dud. That didn't work. And so recently, in December, I started revisiting the Hawara Labyrinth and ended up finding some pretty interesting things there. I went in April with a team.
Hang on. For people who don't know Egypt, like me, where is the labyrinth in relation to, let's say, the Med, Cairo, the Nile, that kind of thing?
It is 95 kilometers south of Giza, let's say, of the Great Pyramid.
Okay.
And it's 30 kilometers from the Nile itself, which to me, with the migration of the Nile, as you'll find in the Pyramid Code, it speaks to the idea that it could be quite a bit older than anybody guessed.
So it's west of the Nile?
Yes.
Okay.
West.
And in the labyrinth, there is, or there was, or there was reported to be?
Herodotus talked about it in 450 BC, and Strini and Pliny and Strombo and Flinders Petrie, all these people have been talking about this place, and, you know, 600 years apart, so they weren't talking to one another. And Flinders Petrie actually has maps of the site, but what they were saying...
Now, Flinders Petrie was a famous 19th century Egyptologist who did some amazing work with very primitive tools.
His book is called 10 Years of Digging in Egypt, 1881 to 1891. And now these books are available online. We still have to respect the copyright and, you know, reference and quote him and what he did. But he did some very good work. And archaeology only started in 1910, so he was doing all this even before that. And I take my hat off to him. I think he did a really good job. So he found...
Well, did you ever hear the story about how he kept the Victorian ladies at bay with his, you know, excavations and measurements and all that? He actually lived on the Giza Plateau. He just set up camp and just stayed there. And he didn't want to be bothered by tourists. And in those years, as you know, there was a great traffic in tourists, you know, particularly Victorian ladies, apparently. Some have actually written books about the experience. So to keep them away, he got a pair of pink long john underwear. And he would wear that as he was scrambling over rocks and walls and whatever. And from a distance to these Victorian ladies, it looked like he wasn't wearing anything at all, so they stayed safely away.
I hadn't heard that one.
I thought you'd appreciate it. He would have been a great guy to talk to.
Oh, absolutely. And even, yes, absolutely. There's all kinds of things that he found. But the thing is, it's in archaeology, older is deeper. And so what they were saying, what Herodotus was saying, is that there were two distinct levels, and they had 1,500 rooms.
This is the labyrinth now.
Yeah. And they called it the labyrinth, and that may be a loose term, but apparently legend has it that the people who built the labyrinth in Crete, at Knossos, the Minotaur, that labyrinth, that they had actually been to this labyrinth. And so there's legends, steeped in legends, and as far as I can see through HD, very powerful satellite scanning techniques that are new to us now, there's four distinct levels, and it seems like four distinct civilizations. So the top one being the Roman, the next one being Ptolemaic, Antony and Cleopatra, and then these two yet undiscovered layers that if you put up the video that I sent, and that may be embedded in some of these other, because there's folders I see on the page that you created for me on the other side of midnight,
okay.
You can actually see the depth and the pyramid and the existing canal.
Would that be clicking on one of the images on your page?
It's not an image. It's actually a video, a short video.
Okay. We've got, the only link I see is the pyramidcode.com.
Okay. So, well, it would be an MP4. So I did send the whole thing. I don't know if Ross is on the other end. But in any case, it's posted in a few other places. It's posted on my YouTube page.
Well,
my
since our web people are so sharp and on the ticket, they will hear this, they will run to their computers, and they will put a link up so we can look at this in the next couple of minutes. So just keep refreshing your page.
And go to YouTube, Carmen Bolter, and you'll see it there.
Okay.
It's a copywritten 3D scan that I had an animation made of. And so, I mean, this is really very, very, very deeply interesting because it's huge and it's deep. And so just on one side of the canal, there's a total of 63 chambers, and six of them are bigger than Olympic-sized swimming pools. And there's a kilometer and a half of passageways connecting them.
And this obviously is much bigger than the chambers under Saqqara.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Like
very
by how
much, like very
by,
much like a whole house. Like all of them except one are bigger than the average size house.
Oh my gosh.
So this is like burying several airports on two distinct levels that are 20 meters apart. So and the they don't connect up and down between the two levels like you would find going down into a tomb in the Valley of the Kings. Those the up down chambers are there.
So the younger stuff was built over the older stuff, but there was no connection. No link.
That's correct.
And do we know for the bottom layers which ones they correspond to? Old Kingdom, Middle Kingdom, whatever?
Richard, it's much, much older.
Oh, well, you've got to make that clear.
Because it's so deep. Now, when
how
you think,
deep?
You know,
did you mention how deep?
Well, no, we're talking 150 feet. The ceiling is 150 feet down. And I'm up
so you're talking similar periods to the stuff around the Osirian?
Even older than that.
Really?
I have never come across anything that has any of the characteristics and the size, but the fact that the chambers, like if you look at temples, the base of one hypostyle hall leads to the entrance to the next, to the entrance to the next. None of these are connected. They're just individual, huge, massive rooms.
Underground?
way, way deep.
Made of? Are they carved out of bedrock, or do they bring in granite, or what?
Well, it's hard to tell the type of rock we can see. Okay, so what it is they're applying software that is a different longitudinal wave signature for each element, pottery, precious metals, precious jewels, water, did I say that already, space, and they can do gas, oil, that kind of thing. And
so this is this detection system you took with you, which
this is something that's coming off the feed of the live satellite scans that's being done out of Germany, and it's brand new technology, and it's being verified. So a lot of governments are hiring this company to find water in Zimbabwe, diamond mines in Bolivia, or is it Brunei, gold in Bolivia. So as they come up with the scans and then go into the field to
Wait a minute, Carmen. Was this technology first kind of surfaced around the loss of MH370?
Nope, it doesn't have anything to do with that. It's been under development for a little while. It's actually, you probably know Klaus Dohna.
I know of him. I don't know him.
Okay, so he has had all kinds of scans done at sacred sites, and his friend in Germany developed the technology. But at the beginning, there wasn't a lot of verification. So what happens with this kind of technology is the validity of it increases over time when they have the exact depth, the water flow rate, whatever it is, and then they go and dig and find it exactly there. So this is the technology they use to find the entrance to the tunnel system of the Bosnian pyramids.
Oh, that's
interesting. Yes, and there's a big Egyptian find in Australia, and they were finding, you know, makeshift hieroglyphic, and then they were looking for the entrance to this big underground place, and they found it through this technology. There's a train in Lake Baikal in Siberia that was lost for years and years, and they found it using this technology.
Oh my God, that would be interesting to see images of that.
Yeah, it was. I have pictures of it. It was lost like 90 years ago, and they've done all kinds of heroic things to find it, and then they did the scan with this.
Was this a part of the original Orient Express or the Siberian Express?
I don't have those details, but there was a treasure on it, and when it sunk, there were a lot of people that were interested in finding the what they had on the train. And it 90 years later, they've now found it.
Oh, my gosh. That's an interesting story all in its own right.
Mm-hmm.
So this
a lot of people hear about this, and they're like, well, I've never heard of that, so it doesn't exist.
Well,
but
a lot of people like...
We have to open up to the idea that new technology is coming out all the time. Now we're up to 4K cameras, which is 4,000 pixels across. Right, 1080p and 720 is like, you know, that was really high definition before. Mm. Now it's, you know, they're leaving that in the dust.
So let me try to understand this technology. This is a German research group. Are they taking commercial satellite images and working with them, or do they have their own experiment on the satellite? Is it passive or is it active?
Well, my understanding is it's real time live satellite feeds. That then there is an additional set of software programs. They're working on the longitudinal light waves, which is similar to barcodes on grocery items.
That makes no sense to me at all. I'm sorry, Carmen. That doesn't make any sense.
Okay, so when you see, barcodes and beep, 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 and it tells the price and it knows, you know, the size of the package and the flavor and all that.
Right, right.
Programmed in to those seeming random bars. Or scans for or whatever you call those bars for a boarding pass,
mm-hmm.
where you have a picture of it on your phone, and they put the beeper on it, and it goes bloop, and it knows it's you.
Right, but those are in a mathematical pattern, and what you apply in the algorithm is a matching algorithm, which then says, oh, I recognize that, that's so-and-so, or that's a such-and-such. But
well,
I don't,
that is,
how can
that's
you
correct.
Scan?
It is Maxwell's equations, and I'm not going to tell you that I can debunk the science here, because I don't... like we can turn a radio on and listen to it without knowing exactly how it works or building one ourselves.
Well, I'm still very confused. You started out by talking about this ancient gunnery range or aircraft target on the Western Desert that you investigated with a balloon, with cameras, you were on site, and then you moved to the labyrinth. But did the same technology that told you what was at that mysterious site that was seen on Google Earth, is that the same technology that was used in decoding the what's under the labyrinth?
No, absolutely not. So we didn't have anything more than Google Earth in terms of finding the place, but I didn't have the GPS coordinates, and I actually did needle in a haystack and looked for it and recognized the characteristic features, found it, got the GPS. We went in there with the GPS and then located the site, you know, and it was all very dangerous, but we had no fancy technology. However, when I was in, you know, sensing it, I know I have felt in my bones that there is a place that has a vast repository of something or other, very deep, very large chambers, very, very old. And this has been corroborated by at least my closest psychic, deeply, deeply, deeply psychic friend. And so that's a hypothesis. That doesn't prove that anything's there. But in the meantime, since 2012, this technology with the longitudinal waves using Maxwell's equations that I'm not going to pretend to know exactly how it works, but my understanding is that it's working with patterns of light that can differentiate between pottery, water, gold, precious jewels, bone, cavities.
See, this sounds like in addition to the electromagnetic remote sensing that we're all familiar with. It does not sound like something that's off the shelf.
No, it's ground-penetrating radar. It's not off the shelf at all. But the other part of it is that most ground-penetrating radar, when you hit a layer of significance, you can't look through it.
But wait, then, if you say they're using ground-penetrating radar, this is from a satellite?
Well, that's the term. State-of-the-art, high-definition, ground-penetrating radar off live satellite feeds using software and logarithms.
But see, there are very few satellites that are using active radar to scan the Earth, and most of those, all of them that I'm aware of, are military. The Russians had a Roscosmos series which used nuclear reactors to power high-powered radar to basically track our ships in the vast Pacific. We've got them. I don't think anybody else does. NASA did one radar experiment looking for under the Sahara, ancient, you know, waterways and ruins and all that. But that was back in the 1980s. So I don't see, I would need to see what these guys are doing or what they claim they're doing. Obviously, ultimately, you got to go and you got to have ground truth. So I take it
absolutely.
You have not been to the labyrinth to see if they're right.
Well, I have. I have been to the labyrinth, but we need permits, and then that involves the Supreme Council of Antiquities, and they've got all kinds of restrictions. So we are in the process of applying for permits, and absolutely, what we get with a scan like this is a hypothesis. And I have been, you know, digging around in here for over 6 months, and it's not that easy to understand. And I could, you know, there's company presentations that show what they've been doing and how these, you know, and I can explain it in words, but because it's not something that we're familiar with, it's not something that many people have heard of, that doesn't mean that there isn't tremendous success happening with the results of the scans all over the world. And so Klaus has been in the Philippines for 5 weeks. They're finding things all over, and there's new pyramids, and they're able to find, like I said, entrances and whatnot, and that has been verified. So I can't tell you single-handedly how it works, just like I said with the example of the radio. I mean, I'm not going to build a radio, but I can turn the dial on and listen. You know what I'm saying?
Yes,
so it's like, so I know that is a stumbling block, and a lot of people say, well, I haven't heard of it.
The stumbling block is I'm a curious person. That's why I'm doing this, finally, after all these years. And one of my curiosities is how can you manipulate the EM spectrum into giving you more information than is currently available through the standard commercial sensors, et cetera, et cetera. Now, if what they're claiming is they're taking standard commercial data and applying different filtering techniques, that's possible. I just would need to see more of how it works before I could accept that it's giving you anything since you don't have ground truth yet, right?
No. And I don't know that we'll get it, you know, because Egypt is one of the most difficult places to get anything done in. And we are applying, and there is a great deal of interest because there's so many legends and stories about the place. And it seems that the verbal tradition would have brought people back to the same place. and that happened. And it seems like there's four distinct levels. And so
there's something about that geodetic location in the energy field that's important to occupy.
Or we don't know. And that's the thing. We have to be, you know, straight shooters here and not claim we know more than we do about it. And the reason that I went public with it, because before it was verified, was because people don't have a lot of respect for international copyright and intellectual property. And I actually found the place, found the coordinates again similarly with the needle in a haystack, and then was able to get the scans and had a connection to the people who were working with this technology, and that was very rare. And then when members of my team were starting to say it was theirs and I had nothing to do with it, Klaus recommended that I go public. So that's why I'm telling you part of a story. And in a typical situation, I would have waited until we had the hardcore data. But because it's so difficult, as I say, you know, to get things done in some countries, I think that it's still an important, some kind of discovery. There's something down there, and this technique is proving, and I sound a little bit clandestine because a lot of the things have been commissioned by governments, and we're not at liberty to talk about other people's findings until they come out. Because so it's almost like, you know, the length of time it takes to, you know, finish a project is lengthy. And so it's premature, but still there's an awful lot of promise with this one.
So you really think there could be a pre civilization buried under that desert?
Yep.
Or maybe two? Because you said there are two separate areas separated. They didn't communicate because one was built after the other was gone?
Well, I think that they're on top of one another, but they didn't connect. And so they're at least 60 feet apart, the ceilings. And that's a lot. And the area, the overall area where we've detected chambers beneath is 81 football fields across.
Oh, my God.
So at 200 cubic feet per hour of sand removal, it could still take years to excavate,
God.
Never mind with those little buckets of sand.
Well, it makes Göbekli Tepe, you know, where they, what, excavated something like 5% since 95? It makes it seem doable compared to this.
Well, the thing is that I always had the vision of those big sand machines that they were dredging out from underneath the sea, mm-hmm. and then reconfiguring to make the islands in Dubai. And apparently that equipment is too destructive. And so if there was ever, you know...
Oh, no, it would be like chewing through an anthill with a bulldozer.
Yeah, but there are other techniques. But the idea of doing it with buckets and 100 men is that would take like 200 years. There's a lot of sand there, which makes it even more curious and interesting. So the top two layers have been excavated already.
The Roman
But no one was ever looking deep enough. So there was a team there in 2008.
When you say the top two layers, you mean the Roman and the Ptolemaic?
Yes, that's
okay.
Correct.
Okay.
And then the others were looking with the, I was going to say, primitive GPR equipment, where they would lay the wires on the sand, and the capability of that was 5 to 12 meters. Well,
right.
We're not even touching the top of any of this yet.
And
it's the new technology that's giving us a view further down.
See, I need to know how this works before, you know, I get too excited, but this is exactly what we suspected should be there. You know, a number of us are working on this problem of who are we and what are we all doing in this place independently. So, to me, that's not surprising at all, given the longevity, the ancient nature of the Osirian and the surrounding structures there.
Absolutely, and the depth, because it's completely underneath the Temple to Seti I, which was 19th dynasty.
Have you figured out any? Let's get into the politics of Egypt and how we might get more information after this break. We shall be back momentarily after a couple of messages. You are listening to The Other Side of Midnight. And we are back with my guest this morning, Dr. Carmen Bolter. We are talking about Egypt. I mean, what better place to talk about than Egypt? And I was just asking Carmen about the politics. We all know back during the reign of our mutual czar of Giza that it was very difficult to get ideas and expeditions and plans and explorations past the bureaucracy that he headed. Have things changed at all in Egypt since he's now no longer with the Antiquities group?
Well, I would say yes. I've met whom I'm calling the new Zahi, and it seems like there's a fresh approach and some real sincerity in terms of excavating at this particular site. Now, if you go, and I have the rule
book. But before you excavate, wouldn't you want to do conventional ground-penetrating radar to really see what's down there?
No, because anything that's conventional has got a limit of numbers of feet of depth, so we would like to submit the scans that are the better technology, the newer, more modern technology. And then, you know, there's stages, but basically you need a permit to do anything, like to start. And so there would be boreholes. Mm-hmm. And there's a device, an on-site device, that makes the satellite scan a little bit more precise and that sort of thing. But there, in the rules for the Supreme Council of Antiquities applications, and I've worked with a lot of these applications before through Ministry of Education, International Academic Cooperation Projects. I've done three of them, and it's a similar process. And so there's 12 pages of rules. And the first number one is no new permits to excavate will be issued in Upper Egypt, and then in brackets it says Giza to Abu Simbel.
But apparently, that's weird.
Well, that's pretty much the whole thing.
Of course, it's all of Egypt, all the interesting stuff that we know of.
I know, and so it's really not easily done, and it has to be done right. And apparently, this site is an exception. And so I think that there's a lot of concerted effort and a lot of interest. And so in 2008 and 2009, there were two distinct teams that were working, and there was money pledged to move a canal, and that through these scans is showing that there isn't water down there. And Flinders Petrie basically said, oh, this is a really interesting site, but you don't want to go dig there because it's got water in it. And that, what it actually did was it prevented people from, you know, getting too excited about what they could find. And so I think that this scan has actually kind of debunked that. Now,
was Petrie just wrong, or was he trying to keep it secret?
I think he was trying to keep it secret, and I think it was very clever of him.
So you think he had actually been down? Otherwise,
well,
how would you know what to keep secret?
He was talking to people. He knew something, and he knew about Herodotus. Now, the guy who built the Suez Canal, and apparently Czar Zahi, is now being employed for the reconstruction of the Suez Canal, but the man named Louis de Bellefonds, which means beautiful foundation, he was hired as a water engineer to build the Suez Canal, and his funders were actually insisting that he use the stones from the Great Pyramid to build the Suez Canal. And he went, nah, not so much. Let's get them from over there. And he had to really fight them, and they eventually agreed. And he simultaneously had a project to divert the irrigation canals at this site. Now, in studying the scans to the extent that I have, what's very curious is the lower level, which is down 150 feet deep, follow the chambers for 800 meters, which is, well, I suppose a half a mile, follows the exact pattern and shape of this canal, which means he absolutely knew. It's very, very curious. And so a lot of people thought they'd have to literally spend $2.5 million moving the canal. And there is water inside the pyramid. Now, the pyramid there is a mud-brick pyramid, which to me speaks of inferior construction.
Much later then.
Much later. Yeah. Exactly.
And this is at the Labyrinth site.
This is.
Which is like 30 miles west of the Nile and what,
95 kilometers, so it's like 60 miles south of Giza.
Okay.
Now, the information, the stories that have been talked about these chambers underneath, were in a document that said you go up two-thirds of the way up the west face of the Great Pyramid, well, right away, everybody's looking in the wrong place. So I spent 5 years in and out of the holes on the Giza Plateau. See, I've been looking for this place the whole time. That's why I was so curious when you sent those pictures of the other one and went, nope. Well, I already went through 5 years and then, nope, it's
see,
not it.
To me, the other one is still interesting because underground, Carmen, the mathematics that I ran, the analysis we ran, says there should be something very interesting. I just don't know how deep. If we're looking at these other guys now, I would say it would be a similar strata, similar plane, probably that deep under that our Air Force, you know, ramshack.
In archaeology, older is deeper.
Yep.
Yep. It's simple. It makes sense. And so...
So you say politically things have changed. How have you progressed? Tell us as much as you can without damaging any diplomatic stuff you're doing. What's the procedure and what are the odds?
Well, our team, okay, first of all, let's just touch on the water again, that in Andalusia, Spain, where this team came from, part of the team came from,
This is this remote sensing team you say is in Germany now.
Well, no, these are people who were interested in being investigators to go and actually dig it up. And they were the ones that did the ground-penetrating radar on site, 5 to 12 meters deep,
mm-hmm.
Through the National Research Institute, and that's all well-documented online. And so they have a shortage of water where they live in Spain. And there's all kinds of passive water systems that came from the Moors in Turkey, and so from Morocco. And they think that the new modern irrigation systems in Egypt could have easily distracted people by putting water in the pyramid, but that doesn't mean that the rest of it... So there's a lot of controversy about the water. With this particular scan, they did a full scan of the entire area just for water, and I call them the puddles, and they're underneath the lower level, and they're small by comparison.
Mm.
So there has been... You know, certain people applying for permissions, and then all kinds of problems happened in the past, and everything was shut down with the revolution. So now the person who is loosely in charge did his PhD research at the site on the mud brick pyramid. So he's particularly interested in preservation because mud brick kind of deteriorates with water.
Mm.
And you can see right through. I've got footage of this. You know, you can see between the bricks because it is eroding. It definitely is. But all that we're talking about that's lower, you know, we have no way of knowing what the construction is, what the relationship is to the bedrock is. But it seems like it's suspended in sand. And it's very curious indeed. So the application process has to happen. The Supreme Council of Antiquities meets once a month. There's rules. It's like applying for a PhD. You've got to have your bachelor's, your master's, high marks, recommendations from other people, a plan for your proposal, and then it goes before a committee, and they want to know that you're going to finish, and there's all these rules with how long you can get to write your report. And not too many people are familiar with all of that, and then you have to have a principal and a secondary archaeologist, but they're not the project leader because they're coordinating everything else, the IT, the local health, housing, for the team and all of that. So it's a huge process, and the chances of getting it are very, very slim. And there's lots of people who are interested in it. So I think that it's important to know that, you know, that we've got technology that can look beyond, possibly. And I don't know what's going to happen next, but I am in earnest. I've been interviewing archaeologists. And I've got this huge spreadsheet, because if you've already worked on a project in Egypt, you can't do another one. And if you're
what do you mean?
Yes, if you've already done a project in Egypt, they ban you from doing another one. Or if you're involved in it for several years after you've done one.
That's bizarre.
Of course it is.
Why?
I don't know.
Are they trying to spread the wealth, or in this case, spread the poverty? In other words, that way they control...
Well, I think that governments aren't really interested in progress that could illuminate something that's empowering to humans. And so, you know, it's hard for ordinary people to believe that governments would be working at cross purposes to us, or their agendas would, you know, be in a completely different arena than who are we and how did we get here.
Hmm.
So it does appear to be the case, And I'm strangely optimistic anyway, because I think that there's a tremendous amount of curiosity about this site. And either they're going to break through and do the right thing and let somebody go and investigate, but also the principal investigator, the principal archaeologist, has to be very, very strong thinking, on their feet, knowing how to deal with the logistics of something like this. And there's very few people who actually have field experience in the Middle East moving large amounts of sand. And I'm going to tell you who one of the candidates are without naming him. when I was going to do my PhD in archaeology, he was my supervisor, and he was in charge of the Queen of Sheba dig in Yemen. And I was a candidate for the expedition. And what happened there is that this is Sabah. This is the Sabian symbols. This is like the real McCoy. It's deeply ancient as well. Mm-hmm. So they'd go in there with the sand removal equipment, and they'd get down to the nitty-gritty, and they'd go in with their little brushes, and they'd photograph the whole place, and that would take the whole field season of 2 months. And then they'd come back to the university, and they'd go back the next year, and the whole temple was full of sand again, so they'd pick another corner, and they'd dig all the way down, and they'd go with their brushes and take pictures. And they did this for season after season, but every single time they came back, the whole temple was full of sand again.
This is in Yemen.
In Yemen. And just before the expedition, something ridiculous like 3 weeks before, the boat was blown up in the harbor off the coast of Yemen in 2001, the whole thing got slammed shut, and no one ever went back there. That doesn't mean that this archaeologist doesn't know how to move large amounts of sand and work in the Middle East and, you know, deal with the mysteries. And so, but, you know, there's very few people who have the combination of skills that would be able to pull it off. From a strict archaeological standpoint, this is a very, very unique situation.
But now, have you approached this guy?
Mm-hmm.
About this project?
Uh-huh.
And?
Well, he's interested in its timing issues because of the university schedule. He's still teaching on this schedule that, you know, September to April, and then it's really hot, and we had Ramadan coming up, and but it's still... No! ...that I've been interviewing, and it's not that easy. It really isn't that easy. Like, I was on the admissions committee for the PhD and master's at the University of Calgary for 6 years. And, you know, people really want to come and do a program, but when you really look at it, there's not that many people that have the skills that will finish, that, you know, despite adversity will get through, that can think on their feet, you know, even with the crème de la crème, as we say. So it's been quite interesting to even try to find archaeologists.
How do you approach someone with academic credentials, good government contacts, previous field experience, long-term decades immersion in the process, the bureaucracy? How do you approach someone like that and say, I've got some very unusual scans here that were made by a totally different technology than anybody is using, and oh, we think we found a civilization under the desert that may go back 30, 50, 100,000 years. How do you do that, Carmen, and get him to...
Well, I skipped the part about the speculation of what it would be.
Okay.
Because that's total hypothesis, right? Until we have something that's verifiable.
Well, but there is the possibility. I mean, the whole idea about the Osirian it being so much more ancient than classical Egypt that we've all known is because of the depth. So the depth itself, if you got any confirmation there's something interesting at that depth, automatically that should say, this is not normal.
Well, in archaeology 101, first day of class, older is deeper.
Yep.
It's a law of archaeology.
And if it's very deep, then it's very old.
If it's very deep, it's very old.
So does that come up in your discussion? Because obviously if you're talking about something that's 150, 200 feet down, it can't be classical Egypt.
No, it cannot. Now, the other thing about this particular archaeologist is that he's examined the entire Middle Eastern area, the Arabian Peninsula, for the disbursement of pottery technology techniques.
Mm-hmm.
And the trade routes for frankincense and myrrh over a 3,000-year period.
This is all within the conventional timeline.
Yeah. But the thing is that he's so prolific in his work, and his work has been focused on this whole Middle East which means he knows how to deal with, you know, the people in present day Middle East and lots of sand. but he would be able to say, looking at all these social patterns, sociocultural patterns over long periods of time, this is what I'm looking for. We've never seen anything like it.
Hmm.
Of all the things we've seen, of all the things we've studied, in this field, pottery, never seen anything like it. Which I'm pretty sure is what's going to happen.
Hmm. So where are you in the process of convincing him to take on this humongous task?
Timing.
Okay.
We've talked at length. But he's not the only one. There's other people. But everybody's got... It really is a giant puzzle.
See, this is...
huge responsibility.
This is the puzzle I'm having, which is, since you and I know what is down there, or could be down there, and what it means, big picture, I would think if anyone was having an honest conversation where the doors were not, you know, adjusted to only let mainstream ideas enter in, there would be a career incentive to find something so ancient, so amazing, so paradigm-shattering that you would instantly become the head of your field if you could substantiate what's waiting. So,
well, not necessarily. Let's think about somebody like Michael Cremo, who, Forbidden Archaeology, you know his work?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, okay. So I'm speaking with him at Modern Knowledge Tour, Vancouver, August 29th, and Victoria, August 30th. I'm thrilled to meet him. But
oh, you've never met him?
I've never met him.
Oh, we went to Chichen Itza with him.
Fabulous. Okay, well, okay. So he's somebody who threatened his own academic career by coming out with things that were unacceptable. And School of Hard Knocks, he stuck with it. Forbidden Archaeology. And the statement is that when they find things that don't fit with the dates that are, you know, extreme antiquity, they bury them again.
Mm.
They put them on boats. The Smithsonian takes them out in the middle of the ocean and dumps them. Now,
yes.
The other thing is it's got to go way beyond carbon-14 dating because that it starts to get really inaccurate. Well, it's inaccurate because there's lots of ways to corrupt the sample. But after 30,000 years, before 30,000 years, it just doesn't work anymore.
I'd heard 50,000, but, you know.
Well, and it's plus or minus 5,000 years. Well, that's not going to give you an accurate date. And so, but the other thing is that he's...
No, but the ballpark would be amazing. If you could spike something at 30-plus thousand years that was technology, that was structure, that was geometry, that would
oh,
blow
yeah.
everything.
Well, and so I saw the dating certificate from the Bosnian pyramids from the external, between the third and the fourth course, they found some organic material, and it dated at 38,000 years. And now at Gunung Penang, which I'm on my way to with the Ancient Mysteries International Tour, November 30th to December 6th.
This is the one in Indonesia?
Yes. They're dating that at 28,000 years.
Cool.
And I'm interviewing that team tomorrow on my Interactive UTV show.
And how are they dating that one?
I'm not sure on the details of that, but I'm sure going to find out because the two archaeologists are coming on tomorrow. So, you know, like there's lots of people that are finding, you know, anomalies and finding new dating techniques. Now, one of the problems that Klaus Dana has had, he found some things in Peru, but nothing in Peru has ever been allowed to be older than 6,000 years, which is that paradigm, you know, construct of the Bible and the Quran,
mm-hmm.
6,000 years. So anything that's older than that... He told me a story of finding a sample that he was convinced was really old, and they kept it for over a year, and then he phoned and said, what about it? And they said, come and get it, and they said, you know, here it is, 5,820 years or whatever, under 6,000, and we're not going to charge you for it, so have a nice day. Which means the lab this is photoluminescent dating. The lab was corrupt. So to find lab that's not going to fudge the data, we've got some challenges to piece the story together.
Do you mean thermoluminescent dating rather?
There's both.
There's infrared.
Thermoluminescent
yeah.
and photoluminescent are two distinct techniques.
Well, I'm not familiar
with the photo.
There's
another technique that will measure how the last time something was heated really high heat, which would be for pottery. And so all these dating techniques have their strengths. And it's very complicated. But carbon-14, to me, is sadly disappointing. I was at what I call the Sitchin Conference in 1996 in Portland, Oregon, with Paula Violette and a bunch of interesting, Michael Talbot, lots of interesting people. Mm-hmm. And they had a round table for scientists on the Monday, and they invited me to be a fly on the wall, which was just a thrill. And one of the, they decided, okay, what are we going to talk about? We're going to talk about dating techniques. And one of them told a story of taking the same sample and sending it to 14 different labs, and they came up with 14 dates.
Oh, my gosh. But, I mean, were some clustered around a kind of a possible date?
Nope. It was just all random, and I just went, that's it.
Really?
Yeah.
That's nuts.
Of course.
How can you build a science on that? Now,
it's
see,
totally disturbing.
See, from our point of view, which is the physics, I have been very suspicious of these dates, both radiocarbon as well as other radionuclei dates, because if the physics changes and the nuclear decay constants change, which of course is heresy to mention that, if you have excursions because of strange solar activity, because this appears to be correlated with very unusual solar activity, they've actually seen some laboratory changes in decay constants literally during major flares, then that dating has to be obviously contaminated because no one's factoring in these potential swings, and they could be significant swings.
Okay, and all of this speaks to how we're crippled in academia. So I just interviewed Rupert Sheldrake up at Hollyhock here in Canada on Vancouver Island, and he talks about, you know, it depends on whether you ask this scientist, you know, during the day at work or on the golf course, because everybody's got their hold-ups, you know, hold up the academic thing and say what you're supposed to say, and then the what they really think. So the whole system is really breaking down. I mean, if you're a truth seeker, then academia actually puts truth at risk, and so does the media and Hollywood, and you know the story.
Well, you've noticed, you know, you just said it, that academia is breaking down. Have you noticed our political system down here is kind of doing weird things too?
Sure. I mean, because the truth is out, and there's a thing, the millennials, kids who were born after the year 2000, I mean, they just take one look at the news and they go, that's not true.
Yep.
And they won't watch TV. You know,
no.
So I don't like those messages. That's just, I'm not doing it.
But they're avid surfers on the web, so they're getting a lot of information that way. Most of their information.
Well, they are, and it's the 2 second to 2 minute attention span.
Mm.
Like, if you look at the Google Analytics, you know, they're literally on a site for 2 seconds. You know, and I think that attention span's a bit too short.
Just a tad, just a bit.
And 2 minutes is supposed to be that you really lingered longer. And they tell you, don't make any promotional videos longer than 2 minutes. It's like, well, actually, it takes not very long to go in depth. I mean, this interview's 2 hours. Okay, we can talk.
Yep. Yep. And
you know, what can we do in 2 minutes?
And nothing. And what's interesting is our numbers. Remember, everything is numbers. So Art and I have been looking at the numbers to see where the trend curve for this kind of programming, radio with pictures, where in the long-form radio, you have time to really get into something in detail and talk about specifics. But with the imagery of the web available, you can also show them things.
That's right.
So you're in the process of assembling a team. You're looking at a couple of head archaeologists, but they've got their academic schedule, which means once you assemble the team, what are they going to present to the Supreme Council that will convince them to give you a permit?
Well, it doesn't work like that. The permit goes in with the project leader, primary investigator, recommending the team.
So that would be you in this case.
Yes. And the people who are, going to do the logistics, you know, the IT person, you know, the local people who will do the, you know, laundry, cooking, all that stuff, that team has to be put together later. But you don't even start, and you can't even go and do, like you can drill, like, 3-inch boreholes and stick an LED light on a HD 3D mapping camera and just go down into the cavity with the accuracy of the smaller unit and go look. And you can even reconstruct that in virtual reality. But until there's an excavation, you don't have you know, the real archaeological evidence. And so it is in stages, but you don't even get to budge. You don't get to dig below the surface of the earth or drill a hole or do anything without the permit.
Mm.
And there is some competition for these permits, but, you know, a lot of people who are applying have nothing on archaeology. Now, I'm not a quote-unquote card-carrying archaeologist, but I did train in graduate-level archaeology and went on digs and that sort of thing, and spoke at international conferences, but I can't put myself in there as the archaeologist because that's not me. But I could be a project leader because I'm trained in that.
So that's why you have to find someone who's big in the field who was willing to spend 2 months digging.
Yeah, 2 months, and there'd be a secondary archaeologist as well. So,
did your friend and you discuss techniques for moving a lot of sand without destroying stuff?
Yes.
Like?
And, well, the dredging, you know, which is meant to have a certain amount of water in there, doesn't work. But there are these units that can be shipped in containers that are actually very, very gentle, that have been designed for finding power lines that are buried and that sort of thing.
Oh. Okay.
And it actually is putting the sand into trucks. And then it can be sifted, because that's what archaeology does, right? If you
Absolutely.
Do it the old way, with the buckets, the leather buckets of a gallon or two of sand, they pour that into a screen, and there's two people going shaky, shaky, shake to see what they're going to find. And that's what's happening at the Bosnian pyramids. They've been at it for 9 years, and they're finding all kinds of stuff in the rubble that was put in to decommission those tunnels, as was Göbekli Tepe. But I think it can be done relatively quickly with the new technology if they'll let us use it. But we, you know, think about it. It's extremely complex to bring the equipment in, to get the permits, you know, and I'm most interested in filming. So if anybody tries to hide it and bury it, you know, we're already streaming live. Here we are with, you know, with stationary cameras that are on time lapse so that, you know, we just see blow by blow what's happening. So, you know, that would be a dream to be able to present that to the world as it's happening and not draw any conclusions. The conclusions about, you know, the what we find, you know, is something else. And I think that might be a little bit of a puzzle, too, because this original document that I found in 1996 at the Star Visions conference in Santa Fe, when Drenvalo was speaking, that was Chelsea Floor, who was showing this thing, and they said you went in, as I mentioned earlier, through the Great Pyramid, and then they went down, 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 and it was all dank and musty, and these two, they did abracadabra or some kind of mantra, and the rock moved, and then they went down. But they went down below the surface of the earth, and everything was just disgusting and dark and, you know, cobwebs and the whole thing. And then when they arrived to this area, it was lit up, it was clean, it was full of technology. Was quite the anomaly.
I can see. We shall be right back on the other side of Midnight with my guest, Dr. Carmen Bolter, after these messages. We are back. My guest this morning is Dr. Carmen Bolter. We are discussing Egypt mysteries, the politics of excavation or the non-politics of excavation. One of the things that you are not aware of in terms of our earlier conversation, Carmen, is that after I had given those images to you of this mysterious place in the western deserts of Egypt, I actually was able to get a network interested in going and doing what you did until some very strikingly bizarre things happened with our discussions. And they wanted to move me out of the way. They refused actually to accept phone calls or emails on this idea after a certain point. And then I got a call from one of my contacts, one of my intelligence contacts, who said that the situation sounded very similar to another program with another network where the president of the network had actually been called by an official and told under no circumstances would programming be approved on that particular topic. And I can't name the topic, and I can't name the network, and I can't name the people. But the idea that, well, that's been the situation up until when? In other words, if you're going in the front door to try to get, you know, permission to excavate down to a layer, which someone has got to know is one heck of a lot older than what we think of as civilization, that is not a small revolution. That, if that's being approved, if the process is going to work its way to fruition, it means somewhere, someone at some level has to have decided it's time for this to be revealed. Otherwise, yeah. I don't think you're going to get a permit to do anything.
Well, the thing is, though, is that they're curious about the fact that it's down there. They may not have any clue about how old or what we find or what to do with what we find. I mean, it's all very contentious.
Do you really think Egyptians who don't talk a lot about their own history are oblivious that they need Westerners to come in and tell them what's under their feet? I mean, Zahi used to give out hints for years about much more interesting things that he simply didn't ever want to talk about.
Well, and he has never been to that site. His claim to fame right now, to this point, is that he's never been there.
Really?
And he says there's nothing there, nothing there, nothing there, nothing there.
See, he approved a satellite investigation, and the show has been on Discover, and it's kind of made the rounds. I forget what woman archaeologist was looking at conventional satellite imagery and infrared and multispectral and was actually looking at some sites along the Nile, and he approved an excavation at one of the sites. I don't remember which one it was, but he didn't seem to be totally closed-minded about looking at new things.
Yeah, so this is Sarah Persick's work, and I'm speaking with her at the Global Pyramid Conference.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And it's been postponed till May in Chicago at a Golden Pyramid. And that's a conference center that they actually built a pyramid. So, but Zahi's like, yeah, there is something to space archaeology. But and there's somebody else, Angela Meikle, who's actually using Google Earth, but that doesn't. And she's admitted that the technology that she's using is nowhere close to what we've used here.
Mm-hmm.
And so Sarah had done some space archaeology from the university in the States, and she found something that looked like a village that was underground. And they went to Egypt and they drilled a borehole and they came up with little bits of pottery and a bead, and they went, okay, there's something down there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a verification of sorts. It's the beginning of a verification. Now, whether they get to do the, you know, excavation or not is another story.
Well, in your case, you'd have to drill a borehole, what, 200 feet deep?
Well, no, you'd hit the first layer at about 60 feet.
Okay.
And we know where there are artifacts. We can see. So we can target for the X marks the spot and go and look around, because we don't know if it's just on the walls or if it's, you know, the room is full. But there are at least six chambers that have artifacts, and there's lots of chambers that have bones. But they're different. And so from studying this for a long period of time, it seems like there's actually three different constructions and then layers and layers of later of bones that aren't as deep.
This could be so mind-boggling.
It's boggled my mind.
Yeah, the question is, will you be allowed? See, excuse me. We're seeing trend curves off the planet in terms of what NASA is showing us and what the Russians are showing us and the Japanese, the Chinese, the Europeans. They're all in their various space programs, particularly the Europeans and the two NASA missions that I talk about quite a bit. They're showing us astonishing off-world artifacts, and they're just stashing them in the archives. And this has been going on, and I've been talking to my colleagues, my imaging processors, who I have a kind of a network of people that I work with and I talk to, and we're all agreed this change, this fundamental change in stuffing the archives with real, extraordinary data, but saying nothing about it. Looks to us like an insurance policy, like someone is anticipating that this is all going to come out. It's like pulling on one thread. If you pull on any one of these threads, you know, ancient archaeology on this planet, archaeology on other planets, ancient archaeology on Pluto, whatever, once that gets going, that snowball starts rolling down that hill, there's going to be no stopping it. So all kinds of stuff is going to come out as people suddenly take this as permission to say something. So,
well, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, in that political climate, it is not inconceivable that if someone is getting ready to tell us who the hell we really are, in whatever form, that part of it would be ground truth here. So I would forecast politically that if our models of the change of consciousness of this is at all accurate, you might find the political process of getting permits to go and do this a lot easier than you might imagine. In other words, a real test.
Having seen so many PhD and master's applications and knowing what it takes and being a professor for a long time, and even in interviewing, you know, you put an ad in when I was director of the Women's Therapy and Research Center, and 500 people would apply for the job. And, you know, a lot of them just ended up in the circular file. And, you know, to narrow down to 10 shortlist and then 3 interviews really wasn't that hard. And a lot of people look good on paper but don't look good in person and the other way around. And it turned out with 500 applications that it was only one person who looked good on paper, looked good, could do the job, got hired. Hmm. And so a lot of people apply for these things, and they're not up to speed.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if you're sitting on the committee, you know, it could be that it's your friends, but you also want the job to get done. And so it really, really is political, and it really does require a lot of know-how, and it's really, 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 really complicated. And because I've been to Egypt 29 times and lived there 2.5 years and have done a lot of these expeditions, and I've done a lot of, like I said, international academic cooperation projects for the Ministry of Education of Taiwan, Republic of China. And these are big, big grants. And you just have to keep the budget together and all that. And so not too many, you know, like, hey, me and my friend think there's a good idea and we want to go dig, okay?
Well, since you're not with the university at the moment, are you?
Mm-hmm.
You're not.
Okay. I'm retired.
Okay. Yeah, really. So how are you planning to fund this?
Oh, well, the university wouldn't pay for it anyway. We've had some things up our sleeve. We had somebody pledge, you know, somebody who owns a lot of land in the area. First, we need the permit. The rest of it will follow.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
so the permit is kind of like good as gold, but you don't want people who are going to just basically want to cheat you and steal the artifacts and sell them on the black market. You want someone who's a philanthropist, who's into research, who can fund. I mean, we're talking millions of dollars to do this, right?
We've got budgets worked up, and the thing is, because of the permit code, and, you know, it cost me my own money, $550,000 to do it. And, you know, there's ways to cut corners, get sponsorships. The thing is if we don't have anything, if we had all the money in the world and no permit, we've
mm-hmm.
got nothing.
But if you get the permit.
On a permit and on a shoestring, you know, we figure out how to do it on a shoestring.
Okay, so, but if you get the permit, then that's almost like the gold ticket.
It's the only thing. Without the permit, we got nothing.
So what are you doing to ace your permit? Or reading. You don't have to say anything in public, but...
No, but just if there's 12 pages of guidelines, and I'm used to these sorts of applications. And they're extremely deep, and they're very precise, and my brain loves that stuff.
But how can you... Without the ability to show them data that's in the mainstream, in other words, these scanning techniques are very different, how will they substantiate that there's a credibility with these scans that they should give you a permit?
Excellent question, Richard. And that's the task. That's exactly the task. Because would you take a cell phone you had 10 years ago compared to the phone you have now? You know, do you want a 1-megapixel camera or, you know, 14-megapixel camera? Which is better?
Okay, yeah? So what I'm asking is, in your proposal, in your submission, will you have an appendix with data of other remote sensing identifications that were successfully confirmed?
Yes, you'd have to. You'd have to. And, though, am I to put the real scan in that I have? Because I didn't digitize it before.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very adamant and clear of whose intellectual property it was, mine, because I did find it, right? And, you know, all of a sudden they're like, well, no, because we're standing next to you, that's ours. Well, I mean, that's actually illegal. That's not the case. And because, you know, Facebook, you post a picture and everybody thinks it's theirs because you posted it, people just don't understand the real science of it. And so, you know, I've been reticent. I never digitized the scan. And so when I was asked to show it, they had to fly me to Europe to get to see it.
Mm-hmm.
And they were still claiming it was, they just were upping to claim it was theirs. And I saw them coming a mile away. And so in a way, you know, this story is, what do you want to say? It's sensational. It's premature. It's unverified. And that's not usually me, but you know, I kind of just had to come out with it. And I've only done 27 interviews since I did. I made 2 phone calls and sent 2 emails and ended up with 27 interviews.
What is the time frame it takes for the politics of Egypt to grind slowly and come up with a permit if they want to?
They meet every month. They say 3 months before the permit's issued, 6 months before you're actually there digging.
Okay. So when are you actually beginning the process of permitting, you know, getting...
I'm deep in it. I'm deep in it. I've been talking to the New Zahi and the National Research Institute and people in preparation. Then Ramadan came June 18th to July 17th or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's right in the, you know, and then everything, you know, slowly gears back up. So it's not that long ago. So, yeah, I'm on it, and I got 1 foot on the shore, let's put it that way.
Well, it's extraordinary what could happen here. I mean, this could be it. This could be the thing that John West and I and Graham and everybody you know have been looking for, which is evidence that we're not the first high-tech civilization on this planet.
Well, and thank you for guessing that that's the conclusion. You know, that you know, not too many people would even speculate that.
Well, am I right or wrong?
I'm going to give you a check mark on that for sure.
Okay. Hey.
Well, I mean, it's obvious if you think this way, and you've been at it. How many years have you been at it? You know, 30 years you've been at
it's,
this at least.
Yes, yes. And it's interesting how the connection, like, did you look at the photo that I put up at the top of the show tonight?
Mm-hmm.
If you came across that in the Sahara, what would you think it was?
Exactly. But the other thing is that pyramids are showing up all over the place, and many of the new pyramids that are being found are covered with soil because it's pre-diluvian. So the flood comes along, recedes, leaves a bunch of silt, trees grow on the top, and this is true of the Bosnian pyramid, the Serbian pyramid, those in Antarctica, and it goes on and on, China.
I presume you've been to Teotihuacan.
You know what? I'm on my way. I've never been
there. Oh,
my
gosh.
I'm a guest host.
When?
Somewhere I've never been.
When are you going?
October 18th to 24th.
Oh, perfect. Perfect. You know Jaime, of course. Jaime. Yeah. Jaime Moussan?
Actually, no.
Oh, well, I've got to introduce you.
I'm on the wrong track on that.
No, I definitely have to introduce you because Jaime was the one who got us really great political access to Teotihuacan when NBC came to me and said, would you like to talk about maybe doing some special work in the field? And we wound up, Sci-Fi, actually, produced by NBC Universal, did a special on our work, which included measuring Teotihuacan. And as you know, the conventional dating of Teotihuacan is a few hundred years or something like that. But when you get there and you look at the pyramids that have not been uncovered, they are covered, Carmen, in tens to hundreds of feet of stuff.
Hundreds?
Yes. The back of the Pyramid of the Moon has, in places, tens, probably 50, 60 feet of removed overburden sitting on the blocks underneath.
Well, think, that's antiquity.
Yeah, I would think so. And when I was there with this crew, I was trying to say on television, this looks really a lot older than His name was not Batista. What was the guy who excavated Teotihuacan?
I don't know. This isn't my thing.
Okay. Well, he was a Mexican who was, you know, part of the transition in the turbulent revolutionary period, and he thought, oh, I'll excavate these pyramids. And there's a lot of controversy over his excavation techniques and over his reconstruction techniques, as you'll see when you get there. But what I was intrigued with was the places that nobody's touched yet, because it looked really, really old, much older than the textbooks tell us. Much.
Yeah, you know, we're inching our way toward the jackpot here, and even with disclosure, you know, Argentina, Mexico, all these different countries have released their UFO files. It's just the United States that's holding back because there's a big agenda. But the pieces are there, and every day there's more and more and more discoveries, another insight, you know.
Well, what's it going to take to have the big aha? See, I think everybody's waiting for the authority figure to come and tell someone, just or not to come, but just to do it from wherever they are, that it's permissible now to think bigger. Because all this evidence is out there. All you have to do is point to it. Like I said with NASA, they're putting all this stuff in the files to when someone blows the whistle, either officially or unofficially, they can simply look.
It's interesting. It's interesting times. And Modern Knowledge Tour that I mentioned already, where I'm speaking with them, it goes across Canada. But they just did a disclosure event, and Paul Hellyer, the Honorable Paul Hellyer, who was our Minister of Defense years ago, is standing up there talking about the money mafia and how it's all tied together and what the consequences of disclosure is and what they get from not disclosing and all the ways it's being released and, you know, surveys of people who know that there's more. How long can they keep the... They've done a fantastic job of keeping the lid on.
It's absolutely astonishing, Carmen. When you look at the amount of manpower and the amount of money and the amount of effort to suborn each of these... I'm surprised Göbekli Tepe is news, because that is stunningly revolutionary, both in terms of what was done and when it was done.
And then Klaus Schmidt had a mysterious heart attack swimming in his pool in Germany.
This is the guy who found it in 94,
well,
I think?
He was the head archaeologist, responsible archaeologist.
Yeah.
And next thing you know, he's dead.
Amazing. Amazing. You brought
well,
us...
It's tragic.
Go ahead.
No, it's tragic because we are putting ourselves at risk by talking about this. And I feel that. Like, I feel that trepidation when I first came out with this. Like, whoa, how do you know? And I got this email from somebody, you should never mention gold, because if you do, then they're going to come and take it. And, you know, it's like, it's this whole espionage, Hollywood, Indiana Jones, I got the hat, so therefore I get to make the discovery. You know, it's just so... People really are lost. And it's interesting, because mind control... People's loss of brain power. Like, as a 3-year-old, I was concerned that we only use between 5 and 10% of our brain power.
Yeah, well, the
concerned
number.
Concerned that
is...
only 5 and 10% of people use their brain. Like, people are programmed to be consumers and spectators.
Yep.
And it worked.
Well, it works for most, but it doesn't work for that 2%. And 2% is what is required to change everything. So.
Yeah, I agree.
I think there's more than 2%. And I think media like this, where we can connect... Do you realize that you could be talking right now, Carmen, to anybody on the planet?
Mm-hmm.
We're no longer limited to terrestrial broadcast networks. But literally, with digital web technology on any device, smart device, tablet, iPad, wrist watch, whatever, anywhere... I mean, we have calls that will come in when we open the phones if we get to that. From literally all over the planet. Under those circumstances, how much longer can who we really are be hidden?
Well, and since the Pyramid Code came out, I get all kinds of, you know, people making, oh, I know what that is, and, you know, all these, oh, you need to hear about my research. But it's only in the last 2 months that when people write to me and say, oh, like, I've got something for you, that they actually have something.
Hmm.
You know? That's something that I never thought of, something that's legitimate, something that's verifiable. And so it's fascinating. It really, really is.
Now, are you attributing that to a critical mass of more people are familiar with your work or the program, or which is my favorite, we're all actually getting more conscious. We're actually vibrating and
we're
resonating.
We're actually getting more conscious. And I've got scientific empirical evidence of that from my pyramid studies of the effect of the going inside the Great Pyramid, inside the sarcophagus, on the human aura and the chakra system. So I've got scientific equipment. And I've been measuring a lot of this stuff over the time. Like even when the Air Force thing ended up being a dud, and maybe there is something underneath. And maybe that's why they cover it all up with landmines. Yeah, it really is fascinating.
See,
how
Carmen, you really have raised something here. Because when I did the math and found there were key alignments with that location that connected, among other things, to the Osirian unequivocally, I said, okay, if this isn't as ancient as it looks in the satellite imagery, then something else has to be there that they put this on top of. I mean, we're talking a sequence of civilizations which obviously each later guy puts his stuff on top of the earlier guys, not even sometimes knowing that the earlier guys were down there, right?
Well, and the position of the things that looked like spacecraft actually was a tree of life.
Really?
When you plotted it, A, and B, when we did the measurements, like they said, oh, this is nothing, let's go. I mean, well, let's measure it anyway. And there were really super high energetic values.
So then the question
And is, disturbed, and erratically disturbed, because I say because of the bombs. But it was supremely high energy there.
When Robin and I went to Europe a few years ago, and I was invited to measure some archaeological sacred sites with the Akatron. We got stunning readings at one place that I can't relate, otherwise the bad guys will go in and they'll simply take it away. But the indications to me were it was deeply, deeply underground, and the emission was in the form of geometric beams. So if you walked 20 feet to the left, you no longer got the signal. If you walked in the other direction, you got it very strongly. So this, whatever the technology is that was, you know, wiggling our system, our detector, it seems to have the hallmarks of something very old that was buried deep down. That's why I'd like to try this technology with these other sites, because if I'm right, they should resonate very strongly if something is still working.
And they likely will.
Okay, we've got only a couple of minutes before the break. I wanted to ask you about the images that you provided tonight. There's what, 2, 4, 6, 7 images?
Oh, I sent a lot more than that, but anyway.
Okay, well, they only put up 7 for me. We will have a staff meeting.
Okay, you want to talk about them now?
Yeah, sure. We can start.
Going, I see 7. Okay, so the bottom one is the tiny little pyramid.
Oh, wait. The one on the bottom right?
The bottom, the last one, somebody lying down in front of it.
Oh,
and
my
you
God.
See the height of the,
who
the
is
height
that?
Of the people.
See, I thought
this
that was
is
you.
On the inside. Okay, so now you're looking, you know, at this little cement pyramid, which is probably 12 feet high because the people are standing there and they're 6 feet tall, right?
Yeah.
The top of it's blown off.
Yep.
The end here is the end of the X marks the spot, and then you can see the radiation, the radial parts going out. And then around it, on top of the guy's head at the bottom, is this 30-foot wall. But it's only 18 inches high, 12 to 18 inches high.
Really? Interesting.
Yeah. So that's the site that you sent me.
Okay.
And then
now, did you go north of this site? Because there's some interest.
Okay, so look at the one on the bottom row to the left.
Okay, wait a minute. Let me back up. Okay, the one to the left, the one we just looked at.
Yeah, the far left.
Okay.
Okay, so you got the trapezoid, which is interesting.
No, wait a minute. No, I've got a piece of rock that looks sculpted.
Line.
Oh, there we are. Okay.
Okay. So
bottom row, far left. Yep.
The circle in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
Was probably actually where that guy's head was. And the X, you see the push pin.
Mm-hmm.
So the pyramid and the X marks the spot is in the center under the pushpin.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got the trapezoid. But there's such a thing as the Orion trapezoid, which connects to, you know, the sky-ground correlation. And then all the way around the outside is what I measured on Google Earth, 30-foot wall, which turns out that it was true. But low, you can't tell from straight above how high it's going to be. So then there's actually, okay, now go up from the trapezoid and there's the red line coming down and across the white line.
Mm-hmm.
That actually is like a trail in the desert. See, because I didn't know where the second site was. And so you'd have to blow it up, but above, see, and you can, you can, what is it, shift and you click on it and it goes bigger.
Yep.
But all of those, the plane and the two circles that intersect,
mm-hmm.
and the thing that I said was like the tree of life, the upper push pin is the center of that, and it's not that far. So I found it before we went there. We landed among that, and it's all fake. It's all Air Force stuff.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
No, I know.
But in terms of the math, it connects to the Osirian, so I'm saying the site itself might be really interesting if you get down deep enough.
Okay, so then let's just go to the far right one on the top row. You see the size of a person. You see the canal. You see the mud brick pyramid. They call it the Weeping Pyramid because as the water over the centuries, millennia, has come down over it, it's kind of made rivulets that kind of look like tears coming down your face.
This isn't Saqqara, is it?
No, it's Sahara.
Oh, okay.
This is the site. So you see the person
in
the middle.
Okay, so this is the pyramid that's sitting on top of where you think the labyrinth might be.
Okay, so the whole thing in the front, up above on the right side of the canal is where all the jazz is, 150 feet down.
Hmm. You mean between the pyramid
and the
tree?
And you
see
in the background to the left of the pyramid the huge power lines?
Yes.
Like that is, and that goes across the Giza Plateau. They got power lines. All these power centers are full of the electrostatic power lines. And they really bring a lot of perverse energy. So backing out of there.
Yep, in
and
a minute.
The picture
in
to the left of it. So you can see the watchman and the little bits of stone that are sticking out. Now we're still on the left of the canal.
Hmm.
And you see how high the vegetation is.
You know, if I didn't know better, I'd say that picture was taken in 1907.
It could have been.
It looks so ancient. On that note,
well, and I'm sure it hasn't changed that much since. So now going left again.
Okay, we got to take a break. We will be back after this small, short passage at the bottom of the hour. And we're rolling into the night, as Art would say, with my guest, Dr. Carmen Bolter. We're talking about the possibility of an extraordinarily, stunningly ancient civilization under the sands of Egypt that everyone wants to find what it means. We are back on the other side of midnight with my guest this morning, Dr. Carmen Bolter. We are discussing Egypt and what's under the sands of. We were looking at some pictures before the break. We had looked at the right-hand side one in your row of seven, at the top row, at this very interesting mud brick, I guess it's mud brick pyramid, on a picture that looks like it could have come out of a rotogravure magazine from the early 1900s. If we go to the one just to the left of it in that top row,
yep, that's yellow.
Yeah, and
okay.
that one
you're looking at is a picture from a book that's 1881 to 1891, 10 years of digging in Egypt that Flinders Petrie drew.
Okay, so
you see the shape of the of. Pardon me.
This is the one in the top left of that row, the top row.
It's the top row. It's probably the second picture over. I'm in it, with, not on the row. But the yellow one. The yellow one that looks like a line drawing.
Oh, okay. That's a map. There
it's
we
map.
Are. There we are. Yeah.
Okay, now that's how I found the site in the first place, because I got that, and I got Google Earth, and I was trying to line it up. It only took me 2 days. Okay, but look at that. Tomb shafts cut in rock. Chips. Roman village. You see the words, slag mounds, Roman pottery and vintage, chambers, granite pillars, and then across diagonally up, site of the labyrinth.
Mm.
He knew. You see that square around the outside?
Yes.
That's my 81 football fields, 107 acres right there.
Oh, my gosh.
And that, and it's a little bigger than that.
Well, he must have spent a lot of time here. This is for the era. This is a very detailed map.
Okay, I'll tell you what. In the Roman level, they found wooden sarcophagi, and it was the first time they ever had realistic art of humans, and the painting of the deceased, the face, would be at the foot on the wooden sarcophagus. And they're claiming it's the old, and the Petrie Museum in London has this stuff. So they're the oldest realistic paintings of humans, so I'm told.
Hmm.
I don't know how you verify that. But anyway, so that's the whole Roman thing. And then you see that he claimed there were granite pillars, and I stood right there. Hmm. Now, the other thing in the pyramid code is we talk about from every pyramid site, you see another pyramid. So I climbed to the top of the mud brick pyramid, and sure enough, 20 miles away, you see another pyramid. I was like, oh my God.
Well, this goes along with your model, excuse me, that the pyramids are kind of part of some kind of a network.
Yep.
And they
it does, and the farther away it is from the Nile, the older it is. So this canal, it's a curious shape, and that's how I ended up finding it. Anyway.
You mean this S-shaped feature that comes from the top left of the map down past the pyramid and makes
that's the canal. And from the pyramid, let's say the bottom left corner of the pyramid all the way down into the S is the shape of the labyrinth on the red layer, which is the bottom layer.
When you say the bottom layer, you mean the bottom layer of your scan, which
150 feet deep.
Yeah.
He knew.
He had to know. Well, look, if he spent as much time in his, you know, fuzzy pink Long John underwear at this site as he did at Giza... How could he not
know? But I thought it was Giza, too. Now, who's going to... Yeah, I know, it's just mind-boggling. The whole thing is completely mind-boggling. And he was free to just dig and do his thing. So the chips, he sifted about 5 meters deep.
Hmm.
So you see the mounds and the chips?
Of course.
And even to the far right, those little dotted circles, that's chips. So this is a pretty accurate map, I'm guessing. And you see the notes.
Yep.
He was trying to leave a record of what he did and where he went and what he found and what he thought. 1881.
Amazing. I wonder.
And almost nobody knows about Hawara. Who knows about Hawara?
Well, it's not on the guidebook.
Mm-hmm.
Is
okay,
it?
Let's go to the.
Go ahead.
Whatever. It's unknown.
Unknown.
Almost nobody's there. Like the guy when we went. Look at the black and white with the square thing in the middle. The first picture, top row left.
The black and white one, okay.
1670 by Kircher Nassanius. I can't say his name. And when I look at... it's not a great picture. This is a copper engraving. Now...
Well, it looks like an engraving of a labyrinth in the middle.
Well, the center part, labyrinth, pyramid... and brain.
Oh my, you're right.
Now, if I said to you, Richard, without looking at this picture, we're going to come up with something that all at once can represent a labyrinth, a pyramid, and a brain, you'd say, really? What's it going to look like? That's what it looks like.
Huh.
So, what
now, where was this found? This is where? Where is this published?
Inside the labyrinth, there is what? Etchings on the wall? Etchings in gold, we don't know. So all the way around the outside, very similar to the ceiling of the Temple of Dendera, you've got archetypes, a square at the corner, going around the outside.
Mm-hmm.
All these different beings, and if you look at them in a higher resolution, which this isn't, there's what you see on the ceiling, the newly cleaned ceiling of the Temple of Dendera in the first hypostyle hall, reptilian heads, bird feet.
You were describing a couple of years ago, that part had been cleaned, part had not been cleaned, and what you can see in the clean part is really amazing.
Oh, yeah. And this is similar. So,
but let me ask you this. I may have missed where this drawing comes from.
1670, Nathanius Kutcher, saying his name right.
Right.
Copper engraving, replica of what was found inside the labyrinth.
That's what it represents on this engraving, that is what is inside the
apparently
labyrinth.
Apparently he copied it. Now,
Who was the other 1600s guy that went to Egypt?
Napoleon.
No. I'm talking about an earlier, I think he was English. Because he was in the bottom of the pyramid, he was excavating, he was, describing what he found. One of the first guys from England that ever went to the pyramid was in the 1600s sometime. And I don't remember his name. Anyway, if this is accurate, then what you're saying is all these little sub-drawings are representative of what could be inside on the ceilings or on the walls of these deeply buried structures.
Oh, yeah. Now, yeah, on the walls or who knows? I mean, it's just incredible to think. Now,
is there any decoding of what these things could mean? They look like dials.
Well,
and
take a look at it. And
they look like they're referencing time.
Okay, first of all, the archetypes go along the bottom, and the feet are pointing out. And these are a cast of characters. Archetypes are, they exist whether you know it or not. And then inside we've got the brain / labyrinth / pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
And then, to me, upper left, is female biology, male biology, astrology on the right. There's these little openings, and I find that fascinating because the rooms of the labyrinth, it's not a map of the labyrinth because they don't connect.
Mm-hmm.
But all of these little places connect. So to me, this is code. This is very, very deep code, and I resonate with it. I mean, the part of me just goes, ooh, there's something there.
Well,
go ahead.
Well, you raise a really interesting point, because if it's a code, it implies a group that has secret, sacred information. And they're using codes to communicate to their other membership down the corridor of time. And you have to have the code key to figure out what this means. But that means there has to be a group. There has to be an ancient group.
Yep.
And I'm thinking the Shemsu Hor.
Yep. I'm going to go with you there.
Oh, wow.
No, absolutely. Yeah, absolutamente, as they say in Spanish. No. We're good. We're good with this. It's really weird.
See, my model is, and if we have this extraordinary history, Carmen, and we're dealing not with aliens or ETs, we're dealing with us, and we have completely forgotten this stunning, almost godlike epic or epics, when we could use technology and physics to make almost anything happen, something then happens and it all is lost, and there's only this trail from someone preserving this knowledge for when it can be reborn again. The Phoenix model.
Okay, so if we believe, Emperor Constantine in 323 AD made reincarnation illegal and they'd kill you if you thought about it. Okay, but if it was us, knowing that we were going to go into the bloodbath of blood from death instead of blood from life, which is matriarchal,
mm-hmm.
and deteriorate into this horrible state of, who cares about the planet, .com,
mm-hmm.
what would we leave for ourselves? If we were on the committee, us and 12 other people,
right,
to make a plan to leave something encoded so that we could get triggered when there was a slight lifting of consciousness.
That goes back to the idea of surfing. My model is this physics, this background, this matrix, this ether, this torsion field, whatever name you want to give to it, which basically, spits out all the things that we identify in 3D reality as matter and energy and exchanges of energy and all that. if this matrix is around us and it varies, and it varies our very consciousness with its variance, which I was able to measure at Chichen Itza two different ways, that pyramid amplifies the background field, and when people in that field put their hands on the detector, like in this case the Accutron, it went nuts. And even when 100 people were gathered in front of the pyramid in a meditation, when the Gestapo came in, the Federales, to tell them they didn't have the right permits, more permits for our history folks, you could see the shattering of their consciousness in the readings of the Accutron when they were forced to break up.
Right. So I get that.
So we've got this measurement that these structures can interact with us. And if you're in their presence, it increases the efficiency of the interaction because it's like a solid state amplifier. At least that's the way I'm referring to it.
Exactly. And now we have solid state hard drives in our computers.
Yes.
No, you're on it. You're definitely on it. But to get real hardcore evidence, something in the field that can show what you're talking about, and to get the instrumentation, which is part of what Dr. Konstantin Korkoff's all about. I don't know if you followed his...
Hello? Carmen? Did we lose you? Hello, hello? I think we've lost Dr. Bolter. Okay, so let's do this, and I will try to get her back. You're on the other side of midnight. We're approaching the end of the show, and of course, something unusual always happens over here, so we shall return shortly. We are back, and we're really back because, Carmen, you went somewhere in the ether. What was the line you said just before you disappeared?
The concerted effort worked to prevent us from figuring out what we already know. Click.
Amazing.
It's well, look. Amazing.
Yep. Okay. Do we have any more images to go through?
Well, there were, but they're not posted, so no.
Oh, okay.
Oh, well, okay, there's one more, actually. The one in the middle that we didn't look at, which is the bottom line, second picture to the right,
okay,
is from the Crystal Mountain that was very close. When we went on that expedition, we had to do desert camping because it was in the middle of the Western Desert, which is the size of Texas. And so we camped close to this Crystal Mountain. And literally, the whole mountain is quartz.
Oh, my gosh. And, of course, quartz is an incredibly active portion
material.
Well, and
that's the pyramid technology that Valery Yuvarov figured out in Russia, that another Russian scientist, that it's the double helix of quartz crystal under pressure that really is the pyramid energy. It's not the angle. It's not the, it's got the water underneath and all the things that Dr. Sam, the seven features. But quartz under pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Quartz under pressure. And so there's quartz altars. There's Abu Ghraib, and then there's the big quartz altar at Karnak. It had to have come from here. And so that piece that we're looking at there, like the pieces just fall off, these huge hunks. Can you imagine a mountain of quartz crystals?
Oh, my gosh. Like, well, that right there has got to be causing a huge problem in the force. You know, all kinds of...
Problem?
Well,
or?
When I say problem, I mean in terms of the disturbance of the background field. It should stick out like the proverbial sore thumb. That
but
much
it's completely
quartz...
completely isolated, weather-torn, sand everywhere.
Doesn't
you
matter.
Go in with your four-wheel drive.
It's
yeah,
the,
no, it's
it,
powerful.
It's the,
oh
it's, the, it's the intrinsic crystallography at the crystalline level, and it's this huge, natural, solid-state amplifier of the torsion
That's
field.
Right. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And the granite inside the pyramids is there not because of its structural strength, but because of the quartz in the granite.
Because of the quartz, and it emits radon gas.
Well, that's just because, you know, as granite forms, yes, it picks up other stuff. So you don't want to be in an enclosed space for a long time breathing it, but that's all right. So any other images, or should we kind of think of a wrap because we're almost out of time? Obviously, we need...
Let's wrap. So we're going to be going to some of these sites. So the Modern Knowledge Tour is on across Canada now, and you can do a virtual reality of it.
Okay, talk about that. You've got a link at the bottom called interactiveu.com. You're involved in something on online learning. Is this part of the virtual reality tour?
No, but so Richard Garner talked about the Zeitgeist movement, the Thrive movement. Now he's talking about the New Atlantis movement. My next series after the Pyramid Code is called the New Atlantis. I'm in full production of it now. Interactive View is a platform that can help people, you know, collaboratively create a model for an empowered humanity. I've been teaching with it. It took me 3 years to build it. I've been teaching this way for 15 years. And, you know, I'm inviting people to come and do social constructivism, which is collaborative making stuff, not passive, you know, pass a test kind of thing. So that's Interactive View. And so I stream live from 1 o'clock till 3 o'clock, and it's connected to my Facebook page, Pyramid Code page, and Interactive View, interactive-U. There's a CCN button, which is Conscious Consumer Network. And I'll be talking tomorrow with the shamans and the archaeologists from the Ancient Mysteries Tour. So if you go to pyramidcode.com, you'll see the Ancient Mysteries International Tour. We're going to go to Ganon Benang and Borobudur and other places, the statues of Solis. I'm not pronouncing these things right, but that's got the pointed fingers, like Tiwanaku in Bolivia and like Göbekli Tepe and like Easter Island. So that's November 30th to December 6th, and I'm a guest host. Modern Knowledge Tour goes across Canada. Very impressive organization and audience. So I did it last year, and this year it's Vancouver and Victoria. That's where Michael Cremo, Marty Leeds, Nassim Haramein, and me will be on stage for the day. 29th of August in Vancouver, 30th in Victoria.
Where this is coming up right around the corner.
And then October 18th to 24th, I've been invited to be a guest host on the land of the Maya, where we're going to go to Chichen Itza, Teotihuacan, all of that. And it's interesting because Jason Martell was going to be the host, and they invited me to join, and then he dropped out. So kind, sweet person, and this is a very impressive team from ancient explorers. And so it's interesting, as people are less able and willing to come to Egypt because of all the media baloney, if you ask me, because it's been going on since 77. No, you can't go there. It's dangerous, but that's all propaganda. People are more interested in other trips. But the Ancient Mysteries International is going to this 27,000-year-old pyramid, and of course the dates are going to keep changing because of the dating techniques, but that's really old. And there's never been the opportunity for a tour to go there. And it's fantastic value. Really cheap flights out of San Francisco to go to Jakarta. And I'm so impressed with that. And that's Bruce Cunningham, Ancient Mysteries International, figuring that out. Modern Knowledge Tours put together by David Whitehead and Chris Russick. Brilliant people. And then the Land of the Maya is October 18th to 24th, and I'm a guest host, and I'm inviting people to come to that. So you fly in right beside Cancun to Meridia. Beautiful program, just incredible opportunities, actually. And so people are invited to come and do that.
In the last minute we've got, I have an idea. What is the name of Zahi's successor?
Dr. Reda.
Dr. Reda.
R-E-D-A.
And do we have a first name? But you can Google him, right? In other words, you Google head.
Well, he's Dr. Reda to me. He's got a first name, but
okay. This is what I'm getting at. If we're talking consciousness,
what I call him?
What if
Dr. Abdel Halim Reda?
And unfortunately, Dr. Rada will have to wait for another time because we're out of time. Carmen, I really thank you so much for the show, for what you did, for what you expressed, for what you laid out, for what you're doing. And you got to promise us to keep us all informed at the next stage in this unveiling of the things that we talk about on the other side of Midnight.